The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I want to talk with you this morning about space. Space. And I'll begin by asserting that space is a synonym for enlightenment. And you might ask me what I know about enlightenment. And I'd probably have to say, not very much. And I think that all of us know something about enlightenment. There's a contemporary Chan master, Sheng Yan. He's died recently, but he's a very great Chinese Chan master, who talked about resonance. He used this word resonance to mean that when we come in contact with the truth, we know it. Something resonates between us and the truth. Something resonates between us and someone who's speaking the truth. And I find that his thought resonates with me. And what that means is that all of us has some access to what enlightenment is and what Buddhahood is and what Buddha nature is. Now, there's also teaching in Buddhism called Tathagatagarbha. And Tathagata is an epithet for the Buddha, as most of you know, which I'm not going to attempt to talk about at the moment. But Garbha means womb. And the teaching of Tathagatagarbha is that all beings are the wombs of Buddhahood. That means that we provide a space within our bodies in which Buddha's, the seed of Buddhahood, is already present and can grow into a fully enlightened Buddha. And that's true for every single being. The teaching is all beings are the womb of the Tathagata. So given that each of us has the seed of Buddhahood within us and we're already nurturing it, and because of resonance, each of us can know something about enlightenment. And each of us, in a sense, knows enlightenment when we see it. Now, I say this in practically every Dharma talk I give, so I apologize to those of you who've heard this before, but I think it's really wonderful to remember that this is our basis or our foundation, that enlightenment isn't alien to us, and we know it when we see it. So with that as a starting point, I would just add to that this teaching of Tathagatagarbha you will find in Reverend Master Jiu's How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, her book of the visions she had in 1976 when she had her great Kensho. And there's a plate in there in which a small golden Buddha, she experiences a small golden Buddha in her hara. And there's a plate in there which depicts that. So I refer you to that. Reverend Master Mayon once told me a story about Reverend Master Daizui. This was many years ago, and I've never forgotten this. She asked him how he manages to be the head of the order and not worry about it, go to bed and sleep at night and not worry about whether or not the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives will be here tomorrow. And he said, it's all a matter of perspective. He said, if I think very small and just about now and just about right here, I can worry a lot. But if I remember eons of time and the greatness of space, I can relax within what I'm doing. And of course, if you're relaxed in what you're doing, you can do a better job of it, can't you? So, and then there's another story I'll tell you about my Kyojushi, my precepts master. When I was a very young monk, I would go to my Kyojushi all upset all the time. Everything was really hard. Everything was terrible, you know, and I'm exaggerating a bit, but I would go running off to her saying, help me, you know, and I'd unload on her my latest distress. And she would listen to me very patiently, and then she'd say, I think we need to put some space around this. Let's let a little air into what's going on here. And she would say that to me every time. You know, but it's all you have to do is say that, and already you're helped. So what one of the things this teaches me is that we get this sense of things in our mind, you know, there's a disaster happening here and I'm in deep trouble and I need help, and we get very tight and closed down. And I think that both what River Master Daizui had to say and what my precepts master had to say point to the possibility of what can happen when we just let a little space in, a little air in, a little room in, and how much things can begin to open up for us when we do that. When we're all tight and rigid and locked in our conception of how things are, we have no possibility for being creative in finding solutions. But as soon as we put some space around it or let a little air in, we can begin to wiggle a little bit, you know, and our thinking process or our meditation processes are freed up a little bit to see something we hadn't seen. And we begin to see the solution for what it is we're so upset about. So that's a small beginning for how space can be helpful to us in our training. Now, I have a very favorite scientific factoid. And this favorite factoid is that if you take the planet Earth and you take all the space out of it, what you have left is something the size of a basketball. Now, I just find this incredible. It feels so solid, doesn't it? I mean, we're standing on something really solid and we think it's going to be there and we trust it. Well, think how small we must be if you take the space out of us. It's an indication of how much space there is in an atom and in a molecule. And when you put all those atoms and molecules together, you get something that seems very solid, but in fact is mostly empty, empty space. And I also like to reflect, and I'm not even sure this is relevant, but I like to reflect on the vastness of space, the vastness of the universe. You know, the nearest galaxy of any significant size to us, to the Milky Way galaxy, is the Andromeda galaxy. And the Andromeda galaxy is 2.54 million light years away. Now, you know, a light year is the distance light travels in a year. And light travels at the speed of 186,000 miles a second. Now, I didn't do the math, but 186,000 miles a second, and there's 60 seconds in a minute, and 60 minutes in an hour, and 24 hours in a day, and 365 days in a year, that puts the Andromeda galaxy pretty far away, and that's the closest one. And, you know, there are galaxies that are 600 million light years away and further, and who knows what we don't know, you know. So, I think that I think most of us have looked up at the stars and been awed at some point in our life to think about that greatness and that vastness. And I think that kind of contemplation can be really helpful to us because it opens us up. It makes us think in terms of something greater than right here, right now, my small life, my small worry, my small concern. And this thing about, you know, the Earth being mostly space is that not only is it not so solid as we think, but neither are we. And it's very easy for us to think in terms of ourselves and things, objects, as really solid. You know, and when when you try to walk through a wall, there doesn't seem to be much space there. But in fact, there's a lot of space there, and I think that reflecting on this kind of thing can help us to just loosen up that sense of the solidity of everything around us. And along with the solidity of things, the solidity of our ideas and opinions and conceptualizations of how things are. Now, I'd like to just say a little bit about the qualities of space. So I'd like you to think in terms of space like the sky, like an empty sky with nothing in it. So imagine a clear sky with nothing in it, no objects in it, and no point of reference. There's no planets, you know, so you don't know which way to go. So in that type of space, that type of space could be described as vast, unbounded. It has no border, it has no center, completely unbounded, unlimited, empty, open, infinite, still, quiet, and silent, immovable, immaterial, unmanipulable, you can't do anything to it, unshapable, uncontained by anything. You know, as a little kid, I used to wonder about where the universe stopped. And I would try to imagine a wall, but outside the wall would just be more space, you know. So it's uncontained and uncontainable. Immaculate and pure. Clear clarity. Non-resistant. It doesn't resist anything. It's unsupported. It doesn't stand on anything. And perhaps even non-arising, non-abiding, non-ceasing, unborn, uncreated, unchanging, undying. And this, I don't think this is a complete list, but those are the things that occurred to me. And I would like to draw our attention to just a couple of those qualities for a minute, and that's the qualities of stillness, silence, and quiet. And I think that we often conjoin silent and still with solitude. And if you investigate monastic traditions of whatever religion, you'll find that it's always said that for a monk, stillness, silence, and solitude are essential to the development of their religious practice. And I think if we consider stillness, silence, and solitude can sound different from what space is, but in a sense, it's very much what silence and stillness are about, is solitude. And if we reflect on what it's like to be truly still and quiet, alone, it's very much like empty space, isn't it? And I think that the way in which stillness and silence and solitude are said to support the training and practice of monks is equally as true for the laity. So that by putting stillness and silence and solitude into our lives, we can help to support our religious practice and training. I was, a long time ago, at my first, or maybe my second, really intensive meditation retreat. This was the kind of retreat where you meditate for 14 hours a day for 10 days and don't read and don't write. And it was driving me crazy because my mind was so full of stuff. At that point in my life, I had been an academic my whole life. And as an academic, what made me successful, if I was going to be successful, was to pump lots of stuff into my mind. I needed to know everything about my field. And then the thing to do was to be creative and invent something new and write about that and get published, and then you would be successful. So I was reading a lot, and I was spending a lot of time trying to master a lot of material and then come up with something more to add to this huge pile of material that we already had. And that can be a wonderful process because we do learn a lot of amazing things about our world, like the fact that the Earth is the size of a basketball if you take the space out of it. But one day in a Dharma talk, or in a little talk that the teacher of this retreat was giving, he said, insight, and he was talking about religious insight. Insight is not achieved by putting more stuff in. Insight is only possible in silence and in stillness. And those two sentences shattered my world. I can remember doing walking meditation after he'd said this, and I'll never forget where I was and what it smelled like and what it looked like, you know, and because it was so different from everything I knew. And I think, again, of resonance, because I knew he was right. You know, and how did I know that this person who was saying something different from everything I knew, how did I know he was right? You know, I think we recognize the truth. So how do we come to experience space in this way and to know it for ourselves? I would suggest that we do this all the time when we do our meditation practice. One master talks about says about meditation that described meditation as mind suspended in space, nowhere. Now, this might not be quite the way that we talk about meditation practice, but I think it's suggestive of something. Often I've come across the teaching and things that I've read about the Dharma. If you want to tame your bull, give him a big pasture. Now, this little saying resonates with me because I struggle with anger. And we think of bulls as angry, you know, and if you get near them, they're going to get feisty and there will be trouble. But if you give the bull a big enough pasture, it can go out there and run around and work out all its whatever. And eventually, it'll be sitting there smelling the flowers like Ferdinand, you know. And I think this idea, again, you know, if the bull has a big enough space, the bull can function in a way that is according to the nature of a bull and can offer that which a bull has to offer to us. Now, meditation is a bit like this, giving yourself a big pasture. The Buddha taught us that clinging and attachment and grasping are the cause of suffering. And meditation is the practice of non-clinging, non-grasping, non-attachment. So meditation is the space in which we let go of suffering by letting go of clinging, grasping, and attachment. And of course, the minute you let go of clinging, grasping, and attachment, space is opened up. There's more room to move in. Now, I'd like to read you a little bit from, again, the great Chan master Sheng Yan, about how he describes silent illumination. A silent illumination is just another translation of the words for serene reflection. So he's talking about our tradition, which came through China to Japan. He's talking about it a little differently than we do. But let me read to you how he talks about it, and then we'll translate it a bit. He has just, in this book, he has just finished describing the stages of meditation practice and how one comes from the beginning of the practice to enlightenment. And then he says, since it is more natural for people to understand practice as occurring in stages, I have described silent illumination as occurring in stages. It is possible to contemplate emptiness and selflessness, which is how he's describing meditation practice, at any stage in silent illumination. So it's possible to contemplate emptiness and selflessness at any stage in silent illumination. It is also possible to experience enlightenment at any stage of this practice. It's not necessary to progress stage by stage. Now, he doesn't say this first, but in other writings of his, he says the first thing you do when you sit down to meditate is relax. And he really emphasizes this. He says you can't meditate if you're not relaxed first. And I think we can come at meditation like warriors, but in fact, he's saying, you know, relax. And I think we can all see how relaxing opens us up. Relaxation is, in effect, space itself. So this first step that we take creates space in which the meditation can happen. Then he says, stage one is just sitting and being aware of the total body sensation. This stage is entered by completely relaxing the mind and body, either through breath contemplation or directly beginning to sit with total body awareness. The second stage is experiencing the environment as one with oneself. You are the environment, and the environment is you. The third stage of silent illumination is the experience of boundless spaciousness. We cannot experience the mind as infinite, he's saying the mind is infinite, and we can't experience this if it's swamped with discursive thoughts and delusions. We also cannot experience the environment as infinite if we constantly discriminate among sense objects, resulting in narrow points of view. But when thoughts totally subside, and I don't think he means that thoughts stop, because we all know that when we meditate, our thoughts don't stop. But I think he's talking about us dropping off our involvement in our thoughts. We're not so vexed by them, and we're not reacting to them, but the thoughts are just coming and going. When thoughts totally subside, we perceive the mind as infinitely vast, and when all our discriminations stop, we perceive the environment as infinitely vast. Your mind becomes clear and bright, and there is no clinging to self or no self. There is true silent illumination. Now, I just think that's beautiful. And offers this wonderful possibility. But as you can see, he does talk about meditation differently than we normally do. So let me put this same thing in our own terms. When we sit down to meditate, Dogen's instruction to us is to neither try to think nor try not to think, just sitting with no deliberate thought. So when we neither try to think nor try not to think, which is the essence of our meditation practice, we don't hold on to anything and we don't push anything away. We allow what is there to just be there. In effect, it's suspended in space because we're not clutching it and we're not trying to get rid of it. We're not stuffing it down. Like, you know, I have a great tendency to try to stuff things down. It's like a jack-in-the-box. It just pops back up and leers at me, you know, with this wild grin. Sorry, you're not done with me yet. So when we stop trying to keep what we like, getting rid of what we don't like, fiddling, manipulating, shaping, keeping, fixing, trying, when we in effect just let go, and that's, we talk about this over and over again, let go, let go, let go. When we just let go, space opens up, an endless, infinite space. And that's what Sheng Yen is talking about. Now, I myself find that neither holding on nor pushing away is like walking a razor's edge, you know, because you're sitting there. I mean, this is why we call it just sitting, because you're just sitting there. You're not holding on and you're not pushing away. And I find myself, you know, sitting there and instantly I'm grabbing it. Oh, that's nice, you know, or instantly I'm pushing it away. And I, you know, you see yourself pushing away, so you bring yourself back, and then you're holding on, and you bring yourself back, you know, and there's this razor's edge that you're walking. Well, I've come to find as I try to sit there truly just sitting that this razor's edge is actually like being on top of the point of a needle. It's tiny, this place of not holding on and not pushing away. But when I think that when we truly sit on the point of that needle and let go to the best of our ability, that point of the needle opens up into infinite space. And we can actually experience our minds as spacious in this way. For some reason, I think of a drop of water dropping into a completely clear pool and it just, you know, rippling out from this tiny point to this vast infinite space. And I think this is partly of what that line in the most excellent mirror samadhi means, the line that says, when minute, infinitesimally small becomes, when large, it transcends all dimension space. So minute is like the atom, and all dimension space is the universe. And when we sit in meditation and we come to that still point in the center where nothing moves, it transcends all dimension space. And it is my experience that when we do this, our bodies become as empty space. And you can think about this. You know, if you're sitting in meditation and let's just talk about the body for now, some physical sensation arises. You know, often we talk about pain, but it doesn't have to be a painful sensation. If you're actually completely aware of that sensation and not wishing it to be different, you know, if bliss is arising, we want it to stay, and then our mind starts doing all this finagling to reproduce the conditions that made it arise and will make it stay. If it's pain, we want it to go away, but if you actually just sit still there and see it as it is with bright awareness, these kinds of sensations, in my experience, become very penetrable, unsolid. They lose their solidity. They lose their frigidity and their rigidness and become, you know, something that seems like it's not changing. We see that, in fact, it's shifting and changing all the time. The pain is becoming less and more. It's shifting its place. It's shifting its quality. Same with feelings that are not painful. And as we experience that, it almost becomes as if the body becomes something that could walk through a wall. It becomes like incense smoke. You know, you could poke your finger through it and swirl it around. Now, in the body is the hara, which I mentioned earlier in relationship to the Tathagatagarbha. My master taught me that the hara, which, you know, is usually described in the text as three finger widths below the navel, my master taught me that the hara runs from the pelvic floor to the throat. But in fact, the hara is unbounded and unlimited. It's significantly bigger than our bodies. We could talk about it as the empty space within, the womb of it is the womb of the Tathagata. And in that empty space within sits the seat of Buddhahood, as in Reverend Master Jiyu's vision. And this seat of Buddhahood is always constantly blossoming into Buddhahood. Now, when we begin to experience our bodies as empty space, the hara opens up and becomes as vast as the universe. And what that means is that the hara is unbounded and contains all things, all things. There's nothing outside of it. And this fact that the hara contains all things is what makes all acceptance possible. Now, we're taught that all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. It's important to remember that all acceptance is not, it doesn't mean that we like something. It doesn't mean that what has happened is okay or that we approve of it. But what it does mean is that there's enough room for everything to be there exactly as it is. And this all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate, as Reverend Master Jiyu again taught us. And the gateless gate is enlightenment itself. So in this sense, space, the space which holds all things, is enlightenment. Non-resistance, non-rejection. That which can hold everything without turning away from it. Now, Dogen talks about this slightly differently. He talks about dropping off, casting away, throwing away the body and mind. And again, in our meditation practice, that's what we're in the process of doing. When we don't hold on or push away, when we don't react to or become involved in what's arising, our thoughts, memories, emotions, perceptions, conceptions, we cast out self. We empty ourselves. Like my early teacher taught me, you have to empty things out, not put things in. We empty ourselves of our opinions, our ideas, our preferences, our conceptions, all the ways in which we've construed the world to be, which we tend to very tenaciously cling to. Reverend Master Mahon talked about the symbolism recently of a gourd. In Buddhism, the gourd is an important symbol. Because a gourd is something that you dig the insides out of, and you toss those insides away, compost them, and you have an empty gourd which you dry out, and that gourd becomes a vessel for water or anything. So by emptying ourselves out, we become a vessel which can hold all things and which can hold the truth. We become a vessel for the truth. That would be Dogen's way of talking about it. Now, to take a different tact, and I have to confess that I wrote this talk without realizing that Reverend Master Jisho was going to talk about emptiness yesterday, so I may repeat some of what he said, and I apologize to those of you who were there, but perhaps it won't matter. Meditation is also the practice of shunyata. Shunyata is a teaching in Buddhism which was translated by Reverend Master Jiu as purity, because she wanted to emphasize the positive side of shunyata. But it's often translated as emptiness. And what it means is that all things are empty of self-existence. There is no separate self, no independently existing self. No thing exists alone or of itself. That's because all things arise out of causes and conditions. So everything is interdependent. Nothing exists alone or by itself. And no thing has an essence which we can separate out and say, this is what that thing is. Here it is. Here's me, you know, right here. So all things, including ourselves, are empty of self-existence. All phenomena lack inherent existence. What this means is that all things are void of characteristics, and nothing we can say about them is in fact true. Now, we are constantly giving things characteristics. This is what language is all about. You know, we say that the reading stand here is hard. We say that it's a reading stand. And, you know, the water is wet and that kind of thing. And this is incredibly convenient, and we couldn't function without it. But in fact, none of those characteristics that we ascribe to things are in fact true about them at the deepest level. And any conceptualization we have about something is also not true. And this is because the teaching of shunyata is that no thing exists as a thing. There is no thing to which change, impermanence is happening. There is only the flow of impermanence. There is only fluidity, change, constant flowing. There is no thing to which this is happening. So anything we try to hold on to slips away from us. When we remember it from the point of view of shunyata, or emptiness. This is what the Scripture of Great Wisdom teaches us. The Scripture of Great Wisdom puts the skandhas out there for us and then says, no skandhas. It puts the senses out there and the sense objects and says, no senses, no sense objects. You know, no eye, no ear, no nose, no body, no mind. It puts the Four Noble Truths out and says, no Four Noble Truths. And the 12 Steps of Dependent Origination and says, no 12 Steps of Dependent Origination, no birth, no death. And this can be very frustrating, but what it's doing is, you know, every time we conceptualize a nose as a nose, the Scripture of Great Wisdom is saying it doesn't exactly exist like that. It's not, it doesn't exactly exist in the way that you're thinking about it. And again, we need to do this to live our lives, so that's not wrong. But there's this other way of looking at it. So it's as if we keep trying to construct a reality, and emptiness or our religious practice keeps pulling that reality out from under us. Our training actually does this to us. Every time we try to hold on to something, it gets pulled out from underneath us. And the Scripture of Great Wisdom does this over and over again. We say this, and it says, no, not this. We say that, and it says, no, not that. And the rug keeps getting pulled out from under us. And I have sometimes heard, you know, I've probably talked this way myself, and this is completely legitimate, that we find ourselves in our training walking in the dark and feel as if we're stepping off into an abyss. And just as we step off, the ground arises to meet our feet. And we're supported, and we can go on. But this is actually just the opposite. What this teaching is that every time you've got the ground underneath your feet, and you take the next step, the ground actually falls away. Then you take your next step, and the ground falls away. Well, you can see that after two steps, you're not even standing on anything. And this is, you know, this is really the teaching of the Scripture of Great Wisdom. We don't have anywhere to stand, and we keep thinking that we do. And in fact, every time we try to put something there to stand on, it falls away from us. So, in fact, we're all in free fall. We're all falling through space, not supported by anything. Space is unsupported, and we're unsupported. We're not supported by anything. And, you know, I see myself do this in my training all the time. I say, okay, now I've got it. This is it. I know what to do. I know where to go. And I start down that road, and it falls out from underneath my feet, you know, and there I am in free fall. But the thing to remember is that free fall is only a problem if there's a ground to hit. But if there's no ground, you can just stay in free fall. And everything works out. Of course, this is what we want, is for everything to work out. So you see, I've just posited another reality for us to stand on. And this is... you know, so what's happening is every time we try to construct reality, that construction of reality is pulled away from us. And this is the meaning of that expression, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Some of you maybe haven't heard that expression. I don't mean to upset you. But there is an expression in Zen, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. And it sounds very violent. But this is what it means. It means if you think, you know, that this ground falling up from under us applies even to the Buddha, to enlightenment, to our understanding, to everything within our training. So if you think you have an idea of what the Buddha is or of what enlightenment is, it is in fact wrong. And in fact, our relationship to the unborn is constantly changing. You know, when I was a young monk, I thought that I would get to know the unborn and that would be it. I would know it, and that would be it. I'd be done. Everything, you know, I would have it. But in fact, we do meet the unborn, and we meet the unborn in many small ways, you know, all of us. And how we experience that and how we understand it changes. It never occurred to me that it would change. This was a shock. But in fact, our experience of the unborn and our understanding of the unborn is in constant changing. And so is the Buddha. You know, the unborn itself is changing. It's not just us or our experience of it that's changing. So that's what that expression means. It's not literal, as I'm sure you all realize. But it, part, at least, of what it means is that if we think we know what the Buddha is, forget it, you know. If we think we know what the Buddha is, let that go, because it might be something else too. What this means is that any idea we have of what original mind is, our original nature is, Buddha nature, or even emptiness itself, isn't true. And shunyata, or emptiness itself, is in fact empty of self-existence, which means that we can't even stand on emptiness. And we have to empty out emptiness, in effect. It's not even something that we can... You know, for me, the discovery of the teaching of emptiness was, wow, now I've got it. But in fact, it's not something, it itself is not something we can hold on to as this is it. It too is a conceptualization that isn't the truth about reality. So, shunyata is this lack of inherent existence, which means that there's nothing that we that can be conceptualized. There's nowhere for us to stand. And I think that the fact that shunyata is translated as emptiness, that there's a reason for this, that it is in fact empty. As an empty of things, like that sky I mentioned at the beginning, which has nothing in it, that emptiness is actually pointing us to this space, which is empty. It's actually completely empty. And when we experience our bodies as space and our thoughts, emotions, and our mind as space, this is what shunyata, or emptiness, is. It's the space that's created when we don't create things, when we don't manufacture things, when we don't try to make something of what it is we're experiencing, or what it is that's around us. Now, prajna is the wisdom of enlightenment. Prajna is, we learned recently from one of the monks who gave one of the Sunday Dharma talks, that Reverend Leon, that prajna actually means etymologically before knowing. And I just love that. So prajna is before knowing. And prajna is penetrating insight into shunyata, or emptiness. So in order to have the wisdom of enlightenment, which is prajna, you have to understand shunyata, or emptiness, empty space. So when we experience ourselves as empty, and things as empty, and thoughts, concepts, emotions, and memories as empty, as space, we're actually touching very closely to enlightenment. So when we come face to face with our true nature, we find that space is the mind's true nature. The original nature of the mind is space. We can say that this is our face before our parents were born. This is what we see when we come face to face with our true selves and with our true nature. This direct experience of primordial vastness out of which everything else arises. It makes me think of the lava lamps that Reverend Master Jiu was fond of, this primordial vastness in the bottom out of which everything else arises. And this is the mind which meditates. This is the mind of meditation. this mind of open, vast, empty space. Now, this mind, which is open, vast, empty space, because it's the nature, because it's of the nature of mind, it's awake. So we have awake space. Wakefulness, this wakefulness, I think, is without beginning or end and radiates uninterruptedly, illuminating all our experience. Because of wakefulness, we can see. And I mean see not just with the eyes. So I would suggest that awake space is the ultimate nature of mind. And that there's nothing we can do to get there, or no technique that takes us there to this experience, this living within, which is what it really is, this ultimate nature of the mind, which is awake space. We can't get there or do anything because we've already got it, and it's always there. And it's really always functioning. And we just think that it's something so great and different from what we are that we don't know it. But in fact, we're living within it all the time because we're always awake. Now, I would like to take one more step and suggest that this awake space is what love is. Now, I may be somewhat following my own personal bent here, because for me, the question of how to live with unattached love is really fundamental to my training and practice. So what is this love that I'm talking about? So I want to suggest that this love is awake space. One of our monks recently asked one of the masters what stillness is. And if I remember correctly, and I apologize if I have this story wrong, the master said, stillness is the stuff of the universe. It's what holds the stars in place. And I thought that was just such a beautiful answer. And the answer resonated with me also, because that's what I had been thinking about love. That love is the stuff of the universe which holds the stars in place. So I saw this kind of congruence between great silence and great stillness, vast, abounded, awake space, which resists nothing and rejects nothing, fixes nothing, and holds everything within it in this total all acceptance. That this awake space is what love is. Not rejecting anything, allowing all that is there to just be there. So I would ask then, is there a difference between love and enlightenment? Can we say that space is enlightenment? And I think that I may be in the position of having to dissolve my own mandala, because if we say space is enlightenment, we've characterized enlightenment and we've limited it. And that would be to do an injustice to enlightenment. But I do think that talking about space as enlightenment points to some truth about enlightenment that we can all understand and resonate with. So I'll close by reading a poem from Milarepa, one of his songs. And this poem talks about enlightenment in terms of space, but also in terms of other characteristics. So we'll dissolve our mandala and then we'll expand it again. Milarepa was a Tibetan Buddhist who practiced, very famous, and practiced many years ago. I want to say about 1200, but I may be 400 years off there, in the early days of Tibetan Buddhism. And he left us some really beautiful writings that are collected together in a book called The 100,000 Songs of Milarepa. So I'll leave you with this. Milarepa sang, "Meditate in the unborn nature of the mind. Like space, no center, no limit, like the sun and moon, bright and clear, like a mountain, unmoving, unshakable, like the ocean, deep and fathomable, unfathomable. In response, one of his female disciples meditated, then sang. I am happy to meditate like space, but distracted by clouds and haze that appear there. I am happy to meditate like the sun and moon, but distracted by the stars and planets that arise with them. I am happy to meditate like the ocean, but distracted by the waves and backwash that arise. I am happy to meditate like a mountain, but distracted by the plants and flowers that grow. I am happy to meditate on the unborn nature of the mind, but distracted by thoughts and images that emerge in it. Master, please teach me about these. Can't you just relate to that? Milarepa was pleased and sang, in meditation like space, clouds and haze are its pleasures, remain in its vastness without center or limit. In meditation like the sun and moon, stars and planets are its jewelry, remain in their space, bright and clear. In meditation like a mountain, plants and flowers are its finery, remain in their sphere, unmoving, undisturbed. In meditation like an ocean, waves and backwash are its movements, remain in their sphere, deep and unfathomable. In meditation on the unborn, thoughts and images are its manifestations, remain in their immensity, vast and lucid. So you see, all these obstructions that we think we have are in fact great helps to us.